Well, hello, folks, and welcome. My name is Eric Wells, and I am the Support Group Director for Recovering from Religion. And this is the first video of a new series that we're doing all about the various programs that Recovering from Religion has to offer. So in this first video, we're going to talk about Recovering from Religion's mission and do a really brief introduction into it so you can kind of know what to expect down the road. But who better than to talk about that with me than my good friend and the executive director of Recovering from Religion, Gail Jordan. Gail, welcome.
Thank you, Eric. What a joy and a pleasure and a privilege to be here. And I've got to add, in addition to being the support group's director, you have taken the initiative to put this series of videos together. And I am so grateful. I find that people who volunteer for Recovering from Religion, it sometimes takes them in strange places because our commitment is so personal and so profound that, and now here we are, and you have chosen to do this. And in addition to your RFRX hosting duties, which I know that listeners will know where those are, you've taken upon yourself to try to explain all of the many things that Recovering from Religion does. And I'm so grateful, but I'm so happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for that, Gail. But before we kind of go into the intro, I'd like to learn a little of a bit about you. You weren't necessarily born into a non-religious household. Ooh. You had a really kind of cool story, and this organization has a personal meaning for you too.
Hugely personal, and I won't go into the whole thing. Everybody, it's online in different places. My personal story, but I was raised a religious person. I had my four children in church every time the doors were open. And when my four children, they're all close in age, when they all became teenagers and they came to me with what I would consider normal teenager questions, it rattled my cage and I couldn't find appropriate answers for them. We found the party line, the church answers, you know, God's ways are higher than our ways and whatever. Anyway, cut to the end, the children, each one according to their birth order and their personality and whatever else, made the decision that they no longer believed. And I was the tail end Charlie. They encouraged me and they gave me space to figure out that I was losing confidence in my beliefs to the point that I finally walked away altogether. A little asterisk in my story is that I stayed a little bit longer than I should have pretending because church had been my entire support group. It was my entire community. It was everything. And I knew that was at risk. My marriage was going to be at risk because my spouse at the time didn't share this part of the journey. And so I went through my deconversion. My children were leaving for college about that time. And so I didn't even have my kids around anymore. And because when I say church was my everything, it was my everything. I didn't know another non-believer. Let me correct that. I'm sure I knew other non-believers. I didn't know I knew non-believers because I was in a rural area in the South and it's not a very friendly place for non-believers. So people didn't come out back in the day. It's been, you know, 15 years or more pre-internet, maybe 20 years or more. So as I do this work with Recovering from Religion, it's never very far from my memory what that was like, the feeling of being so alone, the feeling of doubting your doubts because you're reaching these conclusions and at the same time you see everything around you, particularly in an isolated religious area, is crumbling, house of cards crumbling. And so, yes, that's my background. And that's why doing the work that I do at Recovering from Religion is deeply, profoundly personal to me.
Yeah. And your story, while it's really personal to you, it's so something that we hear so much, both in the helpline and especially in the support groups where my church was my life. I started having doubts for one reason or another. I had to fake it and hopefully keep making it, but then I couldn't do it anymore. And I'm lost now. What do I do? Where do I go? And I don't feel safe to talk to anybody, especially folks in the South and countries that have heavily one religion. It comes to mind as like Muslim majority countries or something like that. Mm-hmm. But and my heart goes out to you and the folks who have a very similar story to you, because this kind of work does have like such a personal attachment to it for sure. Right. But How did you first get involved in RFR? When did Recovering from Religion get on your radar?
Let's see. I first met Dr. Darrell Ray, I think in 2011. He was pimping out one of his books at the very first atheist conference I went to. I had done the work to discard the faith, but as I said, I didn't have any community, at all. And I made a decision to go to an atheist conference three states away, just drive and go. And so I went in quietly and sat in the back and was just, oh gosh, overwhelmed. But I met Darrell Ray and he was loud and he was funny. And I fell in love with him in so many ways when I first met him and bought his book and read his book and then bought another book and read his books. And I saw what he was doing. And by that time, Recovering from Religion was a little gem in the back of Darrell's mind in about 2009. And it went through, you know, the growing pains of becoming a full-on nonprofit org. And I kind of watched it grow. And then in the fall of 2015, I was made aware of the opportunity to become the executive director. And while that's not my background, I was just on fire about it. I thought, I want to be part of this. I want to be part of what the vision of this organization is. By its title, I knew that I wanted to be part of it. So I became the executive director in January of 2016. So by my math, we're into our seventh year, if I counted properly. I did that math ahead of time because the math doesn't exactly work out, but you have to count anyway, you have to count the years individually. So I'm starting my seventh year as executive director of Recovering from Religion.
And I got to say, RFR is so much better because of you. And I'm so grateful to have you at the head. And
that's a lovely thing to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that introduction and letting us know a little bit about you. So what is RFR? Like, what is the bare, if there was a sentence to describe what RFR is, what would that be?
What a great question. The mission statement of Recovering from Religion is that Recovering from Religion seeks to provide hope, healing, and support to folks who are struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. And we take that mission statement so seriously on a practical level, because organizations fight what's known as mission drift. You get into this project and that project and whatever, and we always come back into our one mission statement. In fact, I went so far as to take those three significant words, hope, healing, and support, and we've broken our org down into those categories. And if it doesn't fit in those categories, we're not going to develop it, which has brought us to all those wonderful things that you talked about at the beginning and all the videos to come after this one of all of the different places we have. RFR has been organically responsive to the needs that folks have. We started with a 24-hour telephone chat line where you could call a phone number and talk to a trained agent. Over time, we realized it's hard for people sometimes to carve out the privacy for a telephone call. What if we did an internet chat? So we do this internet chat. Guess what? That opened it up to outside the United States, because our phone system was a US-based system. So then that opened it up to outside of that. Wow, that's awesome. We train our agents and our volunteers to hold off on self-disclosure because we want focus on our clients, and we don't want to put too much emphasis on, well, this is my story. We want to talk about the client. We want to give them a place to ask questions. But we noticed they really want to hear, they want to talk to other people who have experienced what they've experienced. I know, let's build an online community. Okay, let's do that. And then that exploded and so everything has been around our support groups, came out of knowing that people want to sit in a room and be understood and to listen to stories and to share their stories. Everything we do is wrapped around that one sentence. We provide hope, healing, and support. And if there is another creative additional way that we can answer the question, how can we help? We're going to look into it and develop it. And so I couldn't have set that question up any better if I had fed that to you, but that's what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. And so Recovering from Religion, it's kind of been very successful, but it has to be filling in some sort of niche, some sort of a need that people have. What do you think that this need fulfills for people?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. sometimes when I'm asked that question, I kind of preface it by saying what we're not first. We're not a deconversion process. You don't come to us asking for help to how to deconvert. That's available and that's elsewhere. And, you know, we try to give you a space to ask your questions. We do a lot of providing resources because we're familiar with them. We know about the books and the websites and the podcasts and the webcast and all that's available to folks. We do a lot of that kind of thing. We do a lot of reflective listening so that the folks can hear what their doubts are. We can repeat it back so that, oh, wait, that's not exactly what I meant, that kind of thing. So we're not a deconversion process. We're also not professional support. We'll talk about that in a minute. We're peer support. These are real people. They're trained and they, you know, they have a skill set and they're refining their skills on how to talk to you about this, but these are people just like you and me. And so what I see as the need, we kind of touched on it when we talked about our own deconversion processes and needing to talk it through, needing to put it out there, needing to get our thoughts together, needing to for some of us for whom religion was extremely serious. It influenced everything we did, from our legacy to our family planning to our politics, all of those things, so that when that goes away, it can be both incredibly liberating and terrifying. And so we try to point people in the direction so that they can see how other people have gotten through it and thrived and continue to thrive. We try to provide resources so that they can get their academic thoughts together. You know, how do I build a life? How do I become moral? And we also try to provide community. Even within RFR, we provide community. And sometimes that's the only community. If you talk, you know, when we talk to some of our clients who are in isolated areas, or maybe they're at home with other believers, or maybe they're in a marriage with a believer, whatever their circumstances are, this is the outlet. This is the community. And that's okay. That's okay. Sometimes the circumstances are in such a way that this is the person doesn't have a whole lot more options at this period in time than what we provide in our online community, our support groups, that kind of thing. So, I don't have to describe the need because it takes care of itself, because that phone rings and those chats come in and those calls come in, because people, it's, as you said, all of the stories are unique and individual, but the experience is universal, especially if you took religion seriously and you have to begin to rebuild your life all over again.
Yeah. And the thing that I see this organization fills is there is never incredibly rarely, if I am religious and then the next day all of a sudden I'm not religious and everything is fine. No, there is this period of time, whether it's a few months, whether it's a few years, or even longer than that, where we find ourselves having lost our old religion, lost our old worldview, and we have to start from scratch and rebuild something and find out who we are and what is important to us too. And so there's this gap between those two points that I don't know of any other organization that can that fills that need and takes care of that gap.
Oh, I agree with you. And I appreciate your insight on that it really is. And I use the word, our clients come to us somewhere on the spectrum of doubt and non-belief. They may be full on still, but just having a few doubts, and they may have been a free thinker out for years, but maybe this little nagging thing has come up or something has brought them to us. And you're absolutely right. There is a period of time. It's sort of like, and I mean, no disrespect to anybody, but it's sort of like those formative years in a childhood where it's everywhere, you're a sponge and you want to absorb. And in a sense, when our clients come to us and wherever it is they are on the spectrum, and they get to the point where, okay, I don't think I believe this anymore. I think I'm ready to let this one go, but where the hell do I go from here? How do I manage relationships? How do I have community? How do I have a good time? How do I make an impact? All of the things. And you're right. What an incredible opportunity we have, which I think is why it's so gratifying to do what we do with Recovering from Religion. How can I help this person along? How can I be part of the system, this Recovering from Religion organization that can help provide the support and help and healing that this person needs?
Yeah, I love your analogy as a kid, because when I had my own experience transitioning out of religion, I wish I had had an organization like this to kind of help, to not only help me sort of navigate this new world or point me in places that I might be interested in, but also to know that I'm not alone. That like if I was in the Midwest when I transferred out or transitioned out of religion, and I felt incredibly alone, surrounded by all sorts of believers. And as you said, you were in the South and felt the same way too.
Oh yeah, clearly. And we have that in our helpline often, where people describe their circumstances. And you just, when you are inside the religious bubble, you think you're the only one with the doubts. You know, religion is uniquely armored against those kinds of things. It accommodates, oh, certainly you can have doubts, but here's the answers when you get around to them. It's like, yeah, that was not as gratifying as I thought it might be to have these doubts. And so when you stick your big toe out of the bubble and you start looking into the actual, in our case, my kids and I, as we researched and tried to figure this out, the first place we went was to our pastor, Sunday school teachers, youth minister, all those things. And we got the party line answers. But when we started studying history and anthropology and other religions and science and got serious about, now, wait a minute, is there a possibility that this could be wrong? Because you don't, that's the one doubt you don't entertain. You entertain when you're inside the bubble. You entertain, I don't have a full understanding of this. This is translated poorly, something, something, something. But you're still inside the bubble. And when you get out of the bubble, there's a Robert Ingersoll quote about what that feels like, about the manacles falling off and facing fearlessly all worlds, that it describes it much better than I can. But I think you're right in knowing that the experience that people are having is it's a limited shelf life thing, because you'll get there. But in this time, how can we help? How can we provide the resources for a person to examine their lives and make a profound, meaningful difference in how they're going to live their lives?
Yeah. Yeah. And what I love about the organization is we don't say this is how you should live. And we completely discourage it. We say, here are some resources, take what you like, take what feels right to you and what fulfills you, and be you. And I have seen in the support groups, people coming in broken and crying, and the world is incredibly dark and scary. They come for a few meetings and I can start to see this spark of hope. And I see them walk out with their heads held higher, and they feeling more and more courageous, and that there is hope out there. And to me, that is just so incredibly rewarding. And I hear these kinds of stories on the helpline too. And through RFRX, people are just incredibly appreciative for the work that we all do in this organization and the gap that we fill.
And it's hard for me now not to kind of take this moment to say, all that we've talked about up to this point, our support groups, our helpline, our online community, that's all peer support.
Yeah.
If our folks are in need of more professional support, we have a way to accommodate that. We can at least try to connect them. I'll spend just a second talking about the Secular Therapy Project, because it's under the umbrella of Recovering from Religion. It's one of our projects, but it's professional support. So sometimes we have to kind of delineate that so people understand. If you're in a town and you go to a therapist, and especially if you're going related to your deconversion, and you go to, you nowadays you look on the internet, you don't see anything overtly religious, because you know that you need to go to somebody that's not, you know, that's not religious. You know that. And so you go to the office and there's no crosses on the wall. I don't see any Bible verses. And you get in there and you make the commitment and you spend a session or two or three or four working with the therapist. And about the time you've bled all over the therapist's office, and they say to you, this sounds like a spiritual problem, and your radar goes up, and they say, you need to find a church community, you need to get on your knees, you need to get right with God. It's devastating. The Secular Therapy Project, we have a professional staff who vet therapists all over the world to ensure that they provide only evidence-based therapies. We check reviews and websites and Yelp and their publications and anything that we can find to vet them. They become then part of the Secular Therapy Project. And when a client is in need of a therapist, they go to our Secular Therapy website, they put in their location, their needs, their willingness, how far they're willing to drive for this kind of a help. And we are able to connect the two of them. And oftentimes people say, why don't you just publish a list of secular therapists? We've got hundreds of them. Why don't we just publish a list? And my answer is, that's kind of intuitive if you think that through, because if you're in a religious area and you hang out a shingle that says, hey, I'm a secular therapist, you can lose most of your clientele, because that word, religious people have a thing with that word. And so we're protecting our clients as well as trying to protect our therapists, because that's just the society in which we find ourselves.
This organization, RFR, is it just like you and Daryl and me, and then there's a whole bunch of volunteers, or is it more organized? He asked knowing the answer.
That's one of those, the allegory of the duck on the pond, very smooth on the surface, but paddling like hell underneath. All those things are components of it. We have a governing board, we have governing bylaws, and we have a board, and we have a behavior policy, and we have a volunteer manual, and we have all the pieces of a nonprofit. You know, of course, we're in compliance with all of the laws that surround being a nonprofit. We have a system to bring our volunteers in. We have training. We have an elaborate interview process to get them in. Not that it's not achievable. It's just we try to be as thorough as possible, because we want this to be a good fit for our volunteers too. Our volunteers are the lifeblood. I use the expression, it's the closest we get to the sacred here, is our volunteers and our reverence for our volunteers. But we want it to be as gratifying experience for the volunteers as possible. So we're careful to ensure ahead of time that it's a good match. So we have that whole system in place to bring volunteers in. All of our directors are trained and interact with one another. We have our leadership meeting coming up next month. I'm not sure when this will be published, but just any random next month, we'll have our leadership meeting. We have an annual leadership meeting so that all of our leaders can interact with one another, so that the podcast understands what the online community is doing and the volunteer system understands what the helpline is doing. And so that's an infrastructure that supports what we do. We also have second only to our volunteers are our donors. You know, we have a variety of donors, as most nonprofits do. We have sometimes we have a corporate donor, we have the big dogs. For them, we are deeply grateful. And they sometimes will give us an infusion that allows us to develop a program that we've been dreaming about. Sometimes we have those big hits come in. But most of what we do is based on our monthly folks, and whether that's $4 a month or $10 a month or $25 a month, it's what keeps us going. We run on a shoestring budget. We absolutely cut costs wherever we can. Because we're a volunteer force, that makes a huge difference, because we have all of these talented, valuable people giving their time and their talent and their energy to us. But that, of course, undergirds everything that we do. So that's a simple question. How's the org work? And it's got an elaborate answer. We're proud of it. We tweak it as we need to, as we go along. When we have a thought for a new program, we don't go willy-nilly and say, let's just do that. We bring a team together. We do the research. We look at what the budget impact is going to be. We look at what, you know, the projection is. We have a team philosophy. One person just can't come in and say, hey, this is the thing I want to do. We insist, okay, put a team together, put a proposal together. And as I said, we work real hard on that mission statement. And is this going to provide more help? How does this provide hope, healing, and support? It's a simple question with a very complicated answer.
So it, the what I'm hearing is that this isn't RFR isn't some fly by night organization kind of held together by some egomaniacs. It from what you're talking about and from my own experience on the inside, the people involved in the organization are mission driven and not ego driven. And it's just been one of the most refreshing organizations to work for and work with. I don't make any money off this at all, but one of the most refreshing organizations to work with that I've ever had.
You know, I'm so glad that you're having that experience, because I tend to get, so biased about it, and it'll bring me to tears to talk about the board of directors. It's so, these are dear, dear, dear friends who I have seen commit over and over and over again. We've had the same board of directors for a number of years. People just continue to give their time. We've had volunteers that have volunteered for us for years. We've had directors. We have directors that are putting in years and years at a time. I don't know that other nonprofits get that kind of thing. I've worked in a few nonprofits. I've worked as a volunteer for other nonprofits, and they come and go. And you do your thing and you go your merry way. And it's not like that at Recovering from Religion. This is personal, and it is so gratifying. I think that keeps our folks around. And the fact that, you know, you use the word, it's not driven by egomaniacs. There's just not that here. Our mission statement doesn't lend itself to that. It's not going to promote a person. Providing hope, healing, and support takes a team of us. It takes all of us working together. The programs that we have developed out of need. So it hasn't been personality driven. It's all about the mission.
Yeah. Excellent. I couldn't have said it better myself. Before moving on to the next thing, is there anything that we should cover that you feel like we missed?
Well, I just love talking about the org. We've got some things, you know, I mentioned just that we take our new ideas and we sort of flesh them out, and we don't just shoot off in any old direction, but we've got some things in the works. We're working hard on our international development. We have a very strong team in Australia, led by a very competent team, an incredible team, and we are seeing growth in Australia by just leaps and bounds. In 2019, we implemented something called the Fall Excursion. I bet you anything there is one of these videos about the Fall Excursion, and the director of the Fall Excursion and also board member Shannon Nebo has done an incredible job of putting together for lack of a better description, a religion recovery weekend. And it's everything that those weekends are. It's up in the mountains. It was in North Carolina for a couple of years. We've got a new venue location. It's away from screens. It's the fellowship piece of it. It's the bonfire piece of it, without any of the religious stuff. And so it's a weekend to get away, a weekend to reflect, a weekend to receive resources, because we have speakers and talks and different things. It's our hope to develop that into other areas, because this is it's a geographical boundary for some folks to come all the way to North Carolina for this, for this weekend. So we're looking to put that in other places. That's awesome. We have a team for that. That's going to be dependent upon donations and what we can pull together for that kind of thing. So there are so many things in the work for Recovering from Religion. You think sometimes, okay, we're there. Now the org is there. We're pulled together. This is the thing we're going to be. And yet there's always another way that our clients help us reveal, oh, that's a thing we could do. Yeah. We could help people that way. So it's just, it's an exciting time to be part of RFR.
Before we wrap up, I would really love to hear what volunteering for RFR has been like for you. Like, how has that affected you? What have you gotten out of all of this work?
Okay, so here's how I say that when people ask me that question. Here's the first thing I say. I'm by profession, I'm an attorney, and I do important attorney things, and I have big lawyer moments, and it's all the whole thing. But the work that I do for Recovering from Religion is the most gratifying thing I've ever done, by head and shoulders, leaps and bounds, more than anything else. We can really feel the difference that we're making in people's lives. I think that expression's a little trite, but when you're part of the helpline, or you're part of the online community, or you're part of one of the support groups, That is not a trite expression. That's a real expression that plays out in the lives of the folks that come to us, that need some support, that need some encouragement, that need some help. And it's my hit. It's, you know, you get where, not for what it does for me, but because what I know it's doing for them. I was there. I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to go through the darkness first, because there is a sense of loss and grieving associated with it. We would not discount that. We have to recognize that, but there is a light at the end of the proverbial tunnel. And when we can help people see the light, we don't have to get them there. We don't have to push their train through the tunnel. But when we can say, there's a light, there is a better way to live, there are resources, there is a way to build a dynamic community, there is a way to live a life with meaning and purpose. And to be part of that, it's been the greatest privilege of my life.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for the intro and mission part of this brand new series about all that recovering from religion does. Thank you so much for joining us. Stick around. We're going to have Dr. Ray on next. He's going to talk about the history of recovering from religion. And once that's wrapped up, we're going to go right into all the programs. So we'll see you in the next video.